Well, good evening, everybody. Good evening. My name's Robin Archer, and I'm the director of the Ralph Miliband program here at the London School of Economics. And it's my pleasure to welcome you all tonight to the first of our events in the Ralph Miliband program this year. Our theme this year, we always have a theme, is actually revolution. But in addition to that theme, we always have one or two special events that try to speak to contemporary developments that are exercising all of us at this time. And this is such an event. It's not a revolution, I think, but in the 3 decades that I've been in this country, it's certainly one of the, if not the, I think, most volatile political time I've experienced. And so I'm very glad and pleased to have this great panel here tonight to help us debate what's happening in the Labor Party and what the future for Labor is in Brexit Britain. We've got 3 speakers. Andy Beckett, on the far right, is both a feature writer on The Guardian and a historian of Britain. His books include When the Lights Went Out, about the 70s and 80s, and Promised You a Miracle, about the early 1980s, both of which have been widely acclaimed and cover periods that are, I think, of critical interest to us again tonight. Next to him is Matthew Goodwin. He is Professor of Politics at Kent and a Senior Fellow at Chatham House here in London. And his multiple works include the prize-winning book, which he co-authored, Revolt on the Right, which I think has arguably been the most influential contribution to try to understand the rise of UKIP and its effect on Labour. And next to me is Dr. Faiza Shaheen, who's director of the trade union-sponsored think tank, the Centre for Labour and Social Studies. And she has previously worked at the New Economics Foundation and Save the Children and other organisations. Dr. Shaheen is an economist who's written on inequalities, on social mobility, austerity, employment and other topics. Well, just to tell you what's going to happen, we've asked each of our speakers to talk for about 10 minutes, starting with Andy Beckett, who'll talk about the historical perspective. Then Professor Goodwin, who'll look at the social bases of Labor's support, and finally Dr. Shaheen, who'll make some comments from an economic perspective. And when they've done that, there's going to be sort of 15 or 20 minutes or so of chair-led discussion. That means I get to ask them questions. And after that, we're going to throw it open to all of you to have a good chunk of time to debate this very important question. But before I turn to the first speaker, can I ask you all to join me in welcoming all of our speakers tonight.
Hi, thanks for coming. I think my role here is to be the kind of impressionistic, slightly woolly kind of humanities slash journalism person, and then the professionals will take over when I've finished speaking. But anyway, I'm just going to say a few things. I'm going to start with a quote. This is from a famously perceptive Labour politician. No one who has observed the party furiously searching for its lost soul can have failed to sense a mood of deep bewilderment. In view of the change in the balance of economic power, most Labour analyses have lost their relevance. It is small wonder in these circumstances that the approach to new policy should be fumbling and hesitant. Now, that was written in a book called The Future of Socialism, and that was published 60 years ago. Labour's won 7 general elections since then, so I think the grounds for pessimism can be overstated. I think the first thing I'd say to be more optimistic is that I'm a great believer in politics ultimately catching up with where a society is going, and I think Labour in the past has survived the end of the traditional working class, as much as that's happened. It survived the spread of consumerism, individualism, materialism, all those things we're familiar with from the 50s, 60s, 70s and onward. And very intelligent people from Tony Crossland, Eric Hobsbawm and so on said repeatedly that Labour couldn't cope with those changes. And yet Labour, not every election, but was competitive maybe every other election. So I think Labour's a little more resilient and perhaps a little better fitted to the times than people often think. And we've got to a point now where Theresa May be weeping crocodile tears, but she's acknowledging that capitalism in the modern kind of post-Thatcher form isn't really delivering the goods for a lot of people in Britain. So that ought to be a kind of social and economic context where Labour can get some traction. So I suppose that's my first kind of woolly grounds for optimism. The second thing I'll say, which will probably be demolished by the people that speak next, is that I'm not 100% convinced that the Brexit referendum exposed Labour as being terribly weak. If you look at the referendum in 1975 on Europe, the previous one, as far as I've been able to tell, almost half of Labour voters voted for what was then not called Brexit in 1975. This time, about a third of Labour voters did. So the idea that Labour voters didn't do what Corbyn told them, assuming that you think he told them anything clear, and that therefore Labour are weak, I think is at least up for a bit of debate. I think personally, everyone has their own view, that Brexit was won by wealthy Eurosceptic Tory voters in the south of England who've been Eurosceptic for a long, long time. But because that's not a sexy story, that's not the narrative we've been given. I think left behind voters voted for Brexit in 75, and they did this time. There's not been a big change in my view. But again, that, I'm sure that will be challenged by subsequent speakers. I guess I'm also have a degree of optimism because I think that if you look at how Labour does, particularly in London, which is always fashionable to discount because London is just a sort of irritating, you know, liberal place. It's got nothing in common with the rest of the country. To quote Rob Ford, who knows a few things about this, that's the electorate of the future. The electorate outside London is going to look a lot more like the London electorate in 20 or 30 years' time. Now, that's no good if you're trying to win a seat in the next election, but the demographics may be moving in Labour's favour in a long-term way, and I think we shouldn't forget that. And I also think it's worth stating that in London, you know, very polarised, the great neoliberal city ought to be, by pessimistic analyses, very bad territory for Labour. And the Tories did very well in London in the 80s, for example. So the idea that London is traditionally a Labour city is not true. Labour's done very well in London in the last 20 years, while London has become more and more right-wing in its daily life. And I think that's interesting. So that perhaps tells you that Labour can get votes in what would you think of as rather hostile territory. A couple of other small grounds for optimism. I think the size of the Labour Party now, you know, the biggest party in Europe, I'm not sure how robust that is. The Economist calls it a pyramid scheme, the expansion of the party. I think that's a bit sneering, but there's probably a little bit in that. But I think the size of the party isn't to be discounted. You know, young people who are the people who are joining don't generally vote. If they started voting, it might be quite helpful for the Labour Party, and it looks like they're beginning to. So that's a change that I like. And finally, I'm a bit sceptical about how many votes you need to win from the left. The argument that's always made against Corbyn is he won't convince centre voters. But turnout's very low in elections now. You don't need to win millions and millions and millions of centre voters in order to win power, like Blair did in the 90s. Turnout's much lower now. So I don't think Corbyn will get enough votes to win the next election, but if he could get 9 million, that might be enough to at least hold the balance of power. You don't need a Blair-sized mandate anymore to win power, unless the turnout goes rapidly upwards. Okay, those are my grounds for optimism. Grounds for pessimism. These are going to be reasonably brief. If you look at the split between Labour MPs and Labour members, in some ways it's worse than in the early 80s. I mean, forgive me if everyone knows this, but in 81, 28 Labour MPs joined the SDP. Now you've got, 171 who don't like Corbyn, you know. So I don't think there will be a split immediately, but the balance of forces within the parliamentary party are different. The left is much more marginalised. And I think rather like the Conservatives under William Hague and under Ian Duncan Smith, there's a huge hangover. There's an enormous number of Labour MPs who basically absorb the assumptions of New Labour. They think that's the only way to win elections. And that whole kind of what I see as a kind of Blairite rump is going to spend a long time just sitting in the parliamentary party dominating it. Well, the Blairite rump has got some very clever people in it. They're not all fools. And they are going to sit there just like the people who pined for Thatcher sat there dominating the Tory party, making life hell for John Major and William Hague and so on for years and years. And so that's a massive problem for Labour if it's going to remake itself. I also think that what I see as the kind of Blairite rump needs to do some kind of thinking about how Britain's changed since Blair became leader. It's not the same country as it was in the mid-90s. The idea that you might cream off the, you know, a bit of tax revenue from a vicious free market, or that young people will all buy property, those assumptions, maybe they were quite right in 94, but they're not so up to date now. So I think you've got a large number of Labour MPs who, in my view, are kind of subscribing to a Labour politics that's relevant to the Britain of 20 years ago, and that's a massive problem for the party. And on the other side, the Labour left, just look at the ages of the people who dominate the Labour left now. You know, John McDonnell, I think he's 65, Corbyn 67. In the early 80s, the Labour left, even Ben was only in his mid-50s then. Ken Livingstone, when he took power in London, was 36. There's a whole massive generation gap within Labour where there's a lot of very smart young people in Momentum, but they're not MPs yet. And until those people, in my view, become more important in the party hierarchy, the Labour left is going to be this kind of strange vacuum with the sort of elderly, respected figureheads, and they're not necessarily very much underneath. And I think that's a massive problem for the party. I think another problem is Labour haven't really done much yet to kind of undermine what I see as the sort of tabloid Tory discourse about what Britain is and what needs to be done to change it. And about 10 years ago, I had a drink with Ed Miliband when he was everyone's favourite kind of promising young Labour minister. And he was in quite an unguarded kind of mood, and we were walking along Piccadilly to this pub where we saw Mohammed Al-Fayed, which was an interesting experience. And we were talking about crime, and he said then, very forcefully, you know, the whole Daily Mail discourse about crime, how it's getting worse and worse, you know, we're going to challenge that because we know we can't win that battle. The Conservatives will always outflank us. And it was all very persuasive, and I had a kind of couple of drinks and thought, yep, you know, Labour's going to change. And I still don't see Labour really having taken those steps to say, you know, the tabloids are read by a lot of people, but they're not read by nearly as many people as they used to be. And yet the picture of the world that they give, whether it's about, you know, benefit fraud or immigration or whatever, that's the version of reality that most people recognise. And polling always shows that. And I think Labour, until they find a way to begin to erode that a bit, are not going to really, you know, make... They're not really going to get traction. The Conservatives under Thatcher in the 70s really did a lot to kind of undermine the credibility of the left of centre picture of Britain, you know, through the press, through speeches, through just good rhetoric. And Labour needs to start doing the same thing. And even under Corbyn, I don't see that much of that going on. The kind of common sense of the age has yet to be undermined by the left. And until that starts to happen, I think there's problems. Finally, a problem for Labour now, which didn't really exist in the early 80s, is obviously the rival parties on the left, or sort of on the left, are much more effective now. The SNP in the early 80s was going through quite a tough time. The Green Party was much smaller. UKIP, who obviously I wouldn't place on the left but are good at getting Labour votes, didn't exist then. So there's a lot, it's much more of a challenge in terms of a splintering left vote now than there would have been, you know, when Labour last had a civil war. That's another problem. I've just got a kind of couple of suggestions as to what Labour might do. I mean, I'm not a columnist, I'm a feature writer, so, you know, my suggestions will probably seem a bit kind of feeble, but I've just got a couple. I think they've got to play for time. They've got to accept that they're going to lose the next election, and they've got to kind of, to a degree, wait for the kind of electoral system, which is so volatile, to kind of do its work. I don't think the Conservatives, who I spend most of my time writing about for The Guardian, are that robust. I think they got quite lucky in 2015. I think what happened in Scotland could have happened at any point in the last 20 years, and it just happened to happen when the Tories needed a scare story. I think Theresa May, you know, quite, you know, nice and crisp. I enjoy listening to her, but I'm not sure that she's a Thatcher in terms of her kind of game playing or in terms of her kind of charisma. I'm not sure there's that much there ideologically that's fresh for the Conservatives. I think that the weakness of the tabloid discourse is that it's still based on the Britain of 1985. At least the new Labour lot are thinking of the Britain of 95. I think that the Conservative picture of the world in the press is very, very out of date. The idea that enterprise and the free market will just save everybody, I think, you know, that might, you know, even if you think that's what should happen, that ain't happening in most of the country. So I think the Conservatives are much weaker than people think. And the economy, I also think, is much weaker than people think. And we'll maybe find out next year or the year after, probably closer to the election. It's no good having an economy in electoral terms that looks good now. The election might not be for a while. So I think things will turn up for Labour, but I think in the meantime, the Blairites have to think about a modernised Blairism, and I think the Corbynistas have to think about a younger version of what he's presenting. It's got to be the equivalent of what Livingstone and co. were presenting in London in 1981 when they took over the GLC, which was quite a kind of hip, young, you know, up with the times kind of version of leftism that was quite up with consumerism and individualism and identity politics as it began to, you know, form then. And I don't see that yet. I see bits of it momentum, but I think there's got to be a lot more maturing. There's got to be younger people from Momentum have got to be standing, becoming MPs. I haven't particularly got a problem with some very disloyal Labour MPs being deselected. I think that's fine. If they've been massively disloyal, they've just tried to deselect Corbyn. You know, I don't mind if a few of them are removed and replaced by people from Momentum, but people from Momentum have got to want to do that. And I don't see that happening very much yet. So I guess what I'd say in summary is I think the next, you know, 5 years for Labour might be pretty awful. The last time Labour had a big kind of internal crisis, it lasted for, you know, from the early 70s through to the mid-80s, and we're in about year two of it now. So it could go on for a while. But I think in the longer term, I'm not sure that the demographics are on the side of the right. I think they're on the side of the left more than people imagine, just as they are in America, which is why Obama won, despite being black and being a liberal. And I think that in time, things will get better for Labour, but it's going to take a while.
Thank you. Okay, the next speaker is Professor Matthew Goodwin. Could I just ask that the lights be a little bit dimmer so that we can see his slides, please?
Is there a clicker?
Is that satisfactory? No. Is there a clicker?
Okay. Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for coming along. So I'm a trained political scientist, and political science has not had a great 2 years in British politics. Go back to the 2015 general election, pretty much every major forecast failed to see a Conservative majority government. Then basically nobody saw Jeremy Corbyn coming. And then with the referendum, well, you all know the story there, hardly anybody saw Brexit coming. So take what I say with a pinch of salt. But I am going to present the pessimistic case for the Labour Party. I'll also share these slides afterwards on Twitter so you can sort of scrutinise. If you believe in opinion polls, you can tear them apart at your own discretion. Thank you. Okay, so I'm going to agree with Andy in a sense that I don't think the Labour Party is going to win the next general election. I don't think the Labour Party is going to come close to winning the next general election. Let's start with where we are now from 2015. If you look at, say, John Curtis, respected academic, you know, specialises in electoral behaviour. Prior to boundary changes, John estimates that assuming Labour doesn't make back any territory in Scotland and the SNP hold fairly steady, which is looking fairly likely, Labour needs to be around 12.5 percentage points ahead of the Conservatives to have a majority government. What does that look like? Well, if that looks like down here, a 12.5% lead will result in a Labour result of around 326 seats. If Labour manages to get somewhere around a 4-point lead, they are still one seat behind the Conservatives. If they draw level, you know, and it's 50-50, the Conservatives still finish ahead, given the mechanics of the system favouring the Conservative Party, and of course this is prior to boundary changes, just underline that fact. If the Conservatives are basically half of where they are now with a 6-point lead, Labour's going to come away with around 236 to the Conservatives' 327. So basically, Jeremy Corbyn and co. need to be hoping for at least a 12-point lead in the polls. Where are they now? Well, this is showing you the Conservative lead over the Labour Party since the 2015 general election, which is here. And we can see this is taken from the YouGov tracker, which is actually nicer to the Labour Party than if we were to take an aggregate from all of the polls. That would present an even more pessimistic picture, because they've got this period here where Labour actually nudges ahead for a short while. But this is basically the pattern of a Conservative lead of between 7 and, on the really bad days for Labour, 12-point leads. So the Conservative advantage, if you like, is pretty entrenched, pretty embedded. Now, of course, that's prior to boundary changes as well. Now, if you look at the latest analysis by Anthony Wells, as an example, the boundary changes will result in a loss for the Conservatives of 10 seats, a loss for Labour, however, of 28 seats, a loss for the Lib Dems of 4, and the Greens may lose Brighton Pavilion. So actually the situation is more bleak, if you like, for Labour than it is on the slides that you're looking at. I think there's a specific challenge as well in terms of leadership. And we know from everything that's been written in political science over the last 20 years that leaders are incredibly important as a heuristic for voters, as a shortcut when making up their minds about who to vote for. And let me just quickly whiz you through some of the main opposition leaders in recent history. You've got Michael Foot, Neil Kinnock, Tony Blair, William Hague, Ian Duncan Smith, David Cameron, Ed Miliband, and there's Jeremy Corbyn. Just to give you a sense of how Corbyn is comparing to those opposition leaders. So 1 year on from his election, you take the average polling numbers for the month 1 year on from when these opposition leaders took over, you can see how the picture changes radically from the Blair era through Thatcher, John Smith, and now we're into the territory of people who never saw power, Ed Miliband, Neil Kinnock, Michael Howard, Duncan Smith, Jeremy Corbyn, Michael Foot, William Hague, and this is 1 year on when Gordon Brown, of course, was the incumbent Prime Minister. So in historic terms, Corbyn and the Labour Party are in territory where basically you've never seen anybody come back to win elected office. His more immediate problem, of course, is Theresa May. And on pretty much every leadership characteristic, whether you ask voters who's in touch or out of touch, who's strong or weak, who do you like or dislike, who's decisive or indecisive, who has ideas or who has run out of ideas, Corbyn is consistently in negative territory in terms of net satisfaction, meaning more people think negatively about him than positively. And this is among all voters, right? Not just Conservatives or Labour. This is among all voters. Theresa May, her ratings are very strong, actually, for an incoming leader. And the reality is, you know, if you look at the ratings for Corbyn, at least, he's never really made a good impression. After month one, he was already in negative territory, -3 in the Ipsos Mori leadership ratings. I mean, Michael Foot actually made a brief but positive impression in month one. Month three, he's down to -17 along with Foot. Month five, he's down to -21. William Hague's now joined the crowd. Month 12, basically where we are now, he's in sort of -30-something territory. Kinnock's in here now. IDS, Michael Howard, Miliband, Cameron. I mean, it just shows, actually, I mean, Blair really very much was in a league of his own. And I guess, you know, in a way, that's all descriptive, and some of you will say, yeah, but the opinion polls have been wrong and so on, and I don't really believe that argument, but, you know, whatever keeps you warm at night. the real problem here is actually about social democracy, and we are quite insular in this debate. The problem isn't Jeremy Corbyn so much as the problem is the intellectual foundations for social democracy. And if you look, as Chris Hanretti has done, and I would strongly recommend reading his stuff, if you look at the average vote shares, the national vote shares for social democratic parties across 15 European states, I mean, basically social democracy has failed to replenish itself as it did in the mid to late 1990s. And this is what we're all talking about. Basically, this climb, this sort of drop in support, which does not apply to the same extent as the Conservatives. When people say, yeah, but everybody's losing faith with mainstream parties, if you look at the comparable data for the Conservatives, it is not the case, or centre-right parties. Something very unique is going on with social democracy. And I want to suggest to you that actually what that is comes down to social democracy finding itself really at the centre of a new conflict in Western democracies, a cultural conflict that is making its message increasingly less resonant to voters who are preoccupied with things that the Labour Party, in particular Social Democrats, don't like to talk about. Identity, belonging, immigration, culture. Okay, and if you look at the British data, you can see across a range of dimensions, there is now, and there perhaps always has been, a very clear, strong divide between the under-35s and the over-65s. This is what Andy was alluding to in their views towards immigration. Is it bad for national culture? Towards intergroup relations? Would you be would you mind if a relative married a Muslim? Towards their conceptions of national identity? Do you think being born in Britain is important to being British? Over 65s really think that's important. Under 35s less so. Their attitudes towards same-sex relations and their attitudes towards Europe. Now, I could show you this in terms of class as well as age, and you'd see a very similar thing. And I could show you this in terms of education, where you'd see a really strong divide between the low-educated and the highly educated. And what does that mean for Labour? It means the Labour base is fundamentally divided. And this is some data from the British Social Attitude Survey that was provided to me by my co-author, Rob Ford. And this is comparing Labour supporters who are over 55, who have a GCSE level of education or less, and Labour supporters who are under 35, who have a university degree or more. And this basically is ultimately what I think it comes down to for the Labour Party and why it's struggling at this point in time. Look at their attitudes towards whether immigrants are a burden on the welfare state. The over 55s, the more highly educated under 35s. Look at their attitudes towards feeling English rather than British, or their attitudes towards whether equal opportunities for minorities have gone too far. And in terms of the share of the Labour vote, this is a really important bit at the end. The over 55, kind of poorly educated, if you want to put it in those terms, it's basically outnumbering the under 35 highly educated by a ratio of 2-1. So I find sympathy with Andy's argument about, well, the future is going to be young and diverse and highly educated. Well, it's going to take a long time to get there. And there's going to be a real opportunity for the older demographic, as it has done with Brexit and the 2015 general election and so on, to make itself heard very loudly. And the other thing I would say is if you look at other European states like Austria or France, go and look at the data on those 18 to 45-year-olds. They're not all progressive cosmopolitans. You know, if you look at, say, the electorate for the Austrian Freedom Party, it's much younger than UKIP's electorate. So there's no reason to argue or to expect the radical right, the nationalist right, to die out as one generation replaces to the next. And just quickly before I finish, there's also some really interesting stuff here that hammers home this the way in which this culture divide now is really undercutting Labour's base. Labour has a problem in retaining voters since 2015. Only 77% of 2015 Labour voters are currently saying they're going to vote for the party. So why don't we just quickly take a look at those people who are leaving Labour and why they're leaving Labour. And when you ask them, this is from some YouGov data, when you ask them, look, what's putting you off? They say overwhelmingly, look, Corbyn's not going to make a good Prime Minister. Then they say Labour won't form a competent government. And then they say Labour's not really representing people like me. And then less so, Labour's moved too far to the left. But just to hammer home my point, we look at their attitudes towards what are the most important issues of the day. The red are the kind of Corbynistas, if you like, the Labour loyalists. You know, they are much less concerned about immigration, about Britain's relationship with Europe. They're more concerned than the national picture and those who have left Labour about health, about housing, about nuclear weapons, about welfare. But the national picture, and these two grey columns, who are people who have left Labour, they are far more concerned about cultural issues, about the perceived effects of immigration, about Britain's relationship with Europe. And here are the Corbynistas. I voted Labour in 2015, and I would do so today. 44% of them say, I want immigration rules relaxed. Okay, only 16% want a harder immigration. Now cast your eye across these groups. These are all the people who have left Labour since 2015. They voted Labour, they're not currently planning to do so. They voted Labour, they definitely won't do so. And this is the column of people who voted for Labour and they voted for Brexit. 75% of them want stricter immigration. How do you think Corbyn's free movement message is going to go down among that constituency? Okay, and the national picture is pretty overwhelming. This is a country that wants stricter immigration, wants fewer migrants, and it wants that particular situation put into place as soon as possible. So Labour nationally and among its 2015 voters, a good chunk of them, is really out of step on this cultural conflict. How bad could it get? The last slide. If you take the forecasts of where Labour is in the national polls at the moment and you factor in boundary changes, we potentially are going back to 1935 territory. Labour Party, according to the electoral calculus, is forecast to take somewhere around 185 to 190 seats. That brings it right back to basically where it was in the 1930s, right before the Second World War. And I would add, actually, in a way, and I'm going to, you know, perhaps push the limit a little bit, I think it could be worse than that. And I'll tell you why, because what this doesn't take into account is the possible collapse of UKIP. UKIP got 13% of the vote in 2015. If the Conservatives win back half of that vote through talk about immigration controls, Brexit, grammar schools, UKIPers love grammar schools, if they win back half of that vote, Labour will lose around 44 seats. Okay, because you've got lots of Labour MPs in seats with very small majorities, places like Halifax, Barrow and Furness, Enfield North, Hampstead and Kilburn, Ilford North, Wirral West, where you've got Labour MPs basically with about 1,000 vote majority, and if the Conservatives just take, you know, 3 or 4 points off UKIP, those seats are gone. Okay, those seats are going back to Conservatives. So that is why the picture facing Labour is incredibly bleak. But underlying that is a deeper conflict that I think is going to erode Labour support over the longer term. Thank you very much.
Thanks. And now we've got Dr. Faiza Shaheen.
Okay, great. Thanks for that. I'm going to not be so pessimistic. Okay, so I don't mind admitting that I had a bit of anxiety when I was thinking about what to say today. And it wasn't just that it's a life goal to speak at LSE, but more that obviously when you think about the future, I think a lot of us get anxiety about thinking about the future. But the future of Labour is my future. It's this country's future, right? So this is really important to get right. And there's nothing that says that we've got it wrong than polls that tell us that we should be negative about immigration, that trolls are probably, maybe even currently, telling me on Twitter that I should go home, which has happened post-Brexit, by the way. How close our hearts have become to Syrian refugees. We've been telling the wrong story for a long time. So there is a lot of anxiety, I think, just out there right now about where we're going. So faced with this hard problem, thinking about the future of the Labour Party, every time I tell people that I'm going to talk about that today, they look at me with sympathy. So faced with this hard problem, I decided to go back to basics and to really look at what the future of Britain is. What are the trends saying? So picking up on some of the demographics, but also looking at some of the economics. How are things going to change? And here's a novel idea, so that, you know, how can the Labour Party react to that and lead and show leadership on these issues and really build a country that reflects the challenges that we face and have answers to some of those challenges. Okay, so I want to start with I'm going to talk through, there's so many different trends, so of course I could talk about climate change. I don't have a lot of time. I'm just going to talk about, I do think climate change is really important, I'm going to talk about inequality in the labour market, and I'm going to talk about demographic change, and hopefully within the conversation afterwards we can talk about other trends. So this is a graph about on occupational change, on total employment. So I want to start with inequality because, of course, I think for many of us, what's happened here with Brexit, what's happened with Trump, is a sign that the politics of inequality is catching up with the economics of inequality, right? So for many people, what we see today is a consequence of huge gaps between the winners and the losers, and a growing number of losers and a growing number of winners, and sort of nothing in between. One of the drivers of that is labour market polarisation, and we see that here, and we see that in many Western countries. So essentially, you see this growth in sort of professional managerial work at the top, and you see this growth in quite low-paid work, right? Not necessarily low-skilled, it's caring work that's very valuable and highly skilled, I would say, but it's low-paid, and this falling number of jobs in the middle. This is a graph that sets out the kind of trends and what way that will go. Does it come up as pink or red? You see what happened up to 2014, and you'll see in purple 2014 to 2024. It doesn't look as if it's that polarization is going to be a lot worse, but it's going to go at the same speed at least, but it's certainly going to worsen. So inequality is going to get worse. And let me be clear about that. There have been, up to this day, no policies that are going to stop this in its track as yet. So the labour market will continue to see polarisation unless there's some dramatic policy change. This, of course, is caught up with issues of precarious work, so zero-hour contracts. We hear so much about that recently with Sports Direct and Deliveroo and this gig economy. This is caught up in this. So we'll have this chunk of people that will be on low-paid and precarious contracts. And it's also to do with technological change. So you would have heard these figures about a big chunk of our workforce and jobs being kind of taken by technological change. Look, in the face of this, the future of labour has to have answers to this, right? And it can't just be immigrants and scapegoating, which is essentially what the story has been till now. And labour has offered nothing fresh on that, so it has to think up fresh ideas on how they tackle this polarisation, what they do about rebuilding the middle, what they do about skills and productivity, but also what they do about welfare. So we've been going in opposite direction on welfare. But actually what these trends tell us is that there's going to be more and more people that need to rely on the state at some point, because essentially they're on hours contracts, zero-hour contracts, short-term contracts. And this, by the way, isn't just those in low-skill or low-paid work. It's also journalists. I don't know if you saw some of the articles about The Guardian. It's also people higher up now. And so essentially, they won't necessarily have the savings. They'll need the state. And that's not the story we've heard. So again, if we want to talk about what's happening in the future, Labour has to think about how it changes the narrative on welfare. It's also about power and collective bargaining. It's the Labour Party, right? I mean, I work for a think tank that is supported by trade unions. But a lot of why this is happening, and one of the key drivers of inequality, and it's worth saying again and again, is this decline in unionisation, because that has affected the power balance between bosses and others. The Labour government or a Labour Party has to be very bold in saying something about rebalancing that power. Let's talk about broader issues of inequality. I really like this, actually, because I think it really gets to the point about this weird reversal of, you know, who's right and who's wrong and then who's getting the blame. And it's been happening a lot. And, you know, part of the immigration story, of course, is about dividing the poor, getting them to blame each other, right? So why is it that my father-in-law, I always say this, and luckily he doesn't really listen to what I say. My father-in-law, who's a Turkish immigrant, he voted for Brexit because he didn't want Romanians to come. And what is that about for him? You know, he works in a factory. I've tried to get at what this is. It makes everyone uncomfortable. But, you know, essentially it's him saying, my factory's really changed. I feel insecure. I can see that there's these people coming, I'm going to blame them instead of something over there that I don't understand, whether it be the system. You know, it's also about communication. I think the left have to get much better at telling that story. So there's been this reversal. But we know that this little guy, he's getting more and more angry. And I think One of the things for the Labour Party is not only reversing the narrative, but it's also being that little guy. I've just finished working on a documentary for the BBC looking at representation within political parties. Like, the number of people going into politics that are from high-income backgrounds, that went to Oxbridge, that, you know, that just don't really connect with everyday life. They don't really necessarily understand it. The Labour Party is much better at that. I mean, and maybe that's part of the appeal of Corbyn, right? He quit uni and he's maybe a little bit closer to that little man. So they need to be that little man. And I'm going to come back to that legitimacy issue at the end. So there's these drivers of inequality that are going to worsen, and Labour needs to speak to that. There's also demographic change. Now, this is a graph of the dependency ratio, for those who don't know. And the dependency ratio is basically the younger than 15, older than 65, versus those in the middle. So essentially, it's a way to measure the number of workers, so essentially kind of net givers to the tax base versus those that need to depend on the state. So this is very important to how the state works and if it can afford to look after its children and its elders. Now, we know that in many high-income countries, we see that dependency ratio rise. So we'll have more kind of, especially old people, to the number of workers in the economy. So this graph here shows, it's indexed to 100. It shows it up to, the dependency ratio up to 2050. And I purposely put a few countries, a few comparator countries, because sure, you can see the UK on there and it doesn't look as bad. And I think even since this, the UK has looked even a little bit better because of immigration. But I did a study a few years ago looking at immigration and immigration trends to the UK. And something that was really interesting that we never talk about, so essentially a lot of the countries that our immigrants are coming from are getting richer. When countries get richer, they hit a point at which not as many people want to leave. So what was really interesting about that study is sort of 2040 or so, you might see just less people wanting to come here anyway. That's the time at which the dependency ratio goes up. We need more workers in the economy if you want to stick to a traditional type of economy where we need to spend on the state. But it's also a time that for a lot of other countries it's got a lot worse as well. So we have a situation where potentially we're fighting for immigrants, right? That's the future. And in that situation, if we've closed the doors to immigrants in the meantime, if we want to become, and it's really sad, you know, I speak to people abroad and they see us now as a country that doesn't want immigrants, who's going to come here? And I think it's just something to think about. We need to be, and the Labour Party needs to be bold that this country will need immigrants going forward. Look, even if you do not buy that and you think that we can have a very different type of economy where we don't have this traditional kind of workers that pay for the state, etc. Picking up on a point made earlier, actually we can't afford, the Labour Party can't afford, I keep saying we, I'm not part of the Labour Party, but the Labour Party can't afford to be negative about immigration, actually. I mean, 2050, and actually I've seen this go up as well, about 25% of the population will be people of colour, essentially. That's not even other white, which, by the way, is the fastest growing population. So 25% of the population, currently more than two-thirds of which vote for Labour. Do you really want to alienate them? And sure, there might be a few years before that really kicks in. But in the meantime, you don't want to become the party of anti-immigration. And the reason why I'm focusing so much on immigration is because I've just been to the Labour Party conference, and I can tell you there are a lot of people that want to start making this point just to win. And that scares me, because winning at what cost, right? So, yes, we're getting more unequal, and we're getting more angry about that. We're growing older, and we're growing more diverse. That's profound change for us. And the response must be a Labour Party that is honest about that, that has vision, that can communicate that and can lead. That's what we need. Let me end on this picture. This is the 2015 intake, and it's a reminder that actually there's some things that the Labour Party is doing quite well at. It's more diverse, it's younger, there's more women. When you look at these faces, perhaps they are potentially the future leaders of the Labour Party. And when we look forward to the future of this country and the Labour Party, we need them to not buy into that anti-immigration sentiment. We need them to not pander to some of those corporate interests and privatisation, because it doesn't fit with reality. It just doesn't fit with reality and where the trends are going right now. And nor does it fit with the country we want to build, importantly. I think there's something really that's really sad and important about this picture as well, that is a reminder to us that Jo Cox is in this picture. I used to work for her husband. And that's a reminder of what happens when you take the wrong turn, when you allow the wrong story to be told. And it must be for the left, it must be for Labour, to be honest about what's happening and to lead. So what is the future of the Labour Party? Well, for me, and I hope as someone that doesn't want to keep being told to go back to my own country, because this is my own country, and for someone that, you know, my aunt's here in the front, so I have to say this, that potentially wants to have kids and not send them to grammar school, wants to live in a kind of open, diverse, prosperous, progressive country, the future of the Labour Party has to be one of courage and hope. It has to be one of honesty, and it has to be one with a plan. And that's what I really want to see from the Labour Party right now. Thank you.
Okay, now, as is the way of these things, everyone just goes over a couple of minutes and we're a little bit behind time. So I'm just going to ask everyone to be a bit succinct in answering the question so that we can get to the floor. But I want to go through each speaker just with one question to start with. And I was very struck, Andy, in your observations that essentially you're an optimist in the medium term and a pessimist in the short term. And your optimism in the medium term had to do with the changing nature of the Londonisation of Britain, I guess you could say. But the most immediate short-term danger is surely that the Labour Party might divide in two. I mean, this has been seriously considered, seriously proposed, and you have thought and written about the early 1980s when the Labour Party did last divide. And I'd just ask you to comment. I mean, it's a big thing to ask, but just in a brief way, do you think that split could happen again, will happen again, and what would be the consequences if it did?
I think it certainly could happen. You know, there's quite a lot of people who hate Corbyn who would happily join another party. I spoke to quite a lot of them for a piece I wrote in The Guardian about the possibility of a split over the summer. I think the fact that Corbyn's won again and won quite easily, the fact that the people who don't like Corbyn don't really have a plan in terms of policy or capturing the party, I think that makes a split less likely. Also, the fact that things did not end up well for the SDP. You know, they ended up with how many MPs in 1983? I think it was six. You know, and they did very well in that election. So I think because things ultimately went very badly for the SDP, despite the excitement, despite the talent that was in that party, I think it makes a split a bit less likely than it was that time. It's happened before. It didn't work. I also wonder whether, even if there was a split, whether that would be absolutely devastating for the Labour left. I mean, various people said to me when I did my Guardian piece, actually, the young vote plus the trade union vote plus London, that's quite a lot of Labour seats. And you might actually find that the Blairite lot, if they decided to go off, might actually, you know, not end up with that many. So perhaps I'm being overconfident, but I'm not sure that a split would be devastating in the way that people predict. But no, I think there won't be a split for a while, and maybe never, because the British electoral system, you know, I don't particularly love it, but it's not kind to new parties.
Thanks. Thanks very much. Can I just turn to you, Matthew? I mean, a central thing you talked about here with this data was that there was a fundamental division in Labour's electoral base. And you highlighted that the sort of cultural concerns were driving that. Of course, we're talking about this at a particular time, and I mean, this data is always a snapshot at a particular time. But it's a time after the Brexit referendum when those issues have been particularly highlighted. So I'd just like you to sort of think about it. in the round, if you would. I mean, the preference-shaping effect of public events, of different political leaders, can alter the salience of economic issues of inequality of the sort that Pfizer was talking about, the immigration issues, which are clearly present in the minds of people at the moment and have been for some time. And I'd just like you to think about it in this way. I mean, is there something that can be done in the current environment to shift the relative salience of these issues in the economic and political environment that we confront now?
Well, I certainly don't think we're in this climate because of the referendum. I think the saliency or the perceived importance of immigration has been on the rise since the late 1990s, and there are some longer-term trends that play into that have been evident across most Western democracies. And, you know, if you look at, say, the literature and political science and what's going on and why social democrats are faring so badly across many countries, you know, there is now, I think it's fair to say, a consensus that the old kind of labour-capital divide, the classic left-right dimension, has increasingly been replaced by a new cultural cleavage in European politics that's pitching essentially, and I'm sort of simplifying it, but essentially social liberals against traditional conservatives, those who are fairly at ease with immigration and diversity, and those who are more conservative and in some cases quite authoritarian. And that's really been coming since the late 80s, and it's a backlash politics, and we're seeing it in Trump, and we're seeing it in Britain, and we're seeing it in France and elsewhere. But that's a politics that is based on values as much as objective indicators. And this is something Labour's never really understood, that Labour's always come at this through a narrative of jobs and wages, and has always felt incredibly uncomfortable talking about things like community, belonging, social change, things that I think people like Glasman and others have tried to kind of kick the party into thinking about. And I think in some respects they were beginning to think about it until recently, when it's almost as if Labour's sort of gone back to where it was before Miliband, who at least was open to the idea of thinking about some of those things. So I'm sort of very gloomy in terms of what can be done. I mean, that's a question not to ask an academic. I mean, the academics are always good at diagnosing, you know, what is happening. In terms of prescription, I mean, I would say headline, simple point is there's a opportunity in all of this for Labour. And that opportunity is to come out with something interesting to say on immigration policy. Not simply to say, you know, we're hostile to immigration, but if you look at the public opinion on immigration, like take students right now. Labour should be going at Theresa May and Amber Rudd about student migration in a massive way. Why? Because most people are comfortable about international students. They think they contribute to the economy. They think they help local towns. This is a kind of migration people like. What people are nervous about is low-skill immigration that is not controlled. And that is why, you know, UKIP and others have done particularly well at exploiting that. So I think Labour, instead of saying, yeah, actually, we're comfortable with free movement, bring it on, I think maybe they should be thinking about, well, what would an alternative immigration policy look like that could be framed in a progressive way, but is also open to actually appealing to people's mixed preferences on that issue? I think it's too simplistic to say, if you talk about immigration, therefore you're xenophobic and that is Nazi politics. I don't think it cuts like that.
Okay, thanks. One could follow up on all of these things, but I'm just going to address myself to Pfizer now. The thing that struck me about what you were saying was when you spoke about the decline of unionisation. And what that made me think, having listened to the debate of the last 2 months in the Labor Party, was this dialogue of the deaf between those saying that the Labor Party's about Parliament and those who say it's a social movement. And, I mean, we know, both historically from other countries, that after great shocks, fundamental changes have been brought about when both of those things have been brought together. In the New Deal in the United States, it was both the electoral success of Franklin Roosevelt and the rise of the CIO unions. And so what I wanted to ask you was, thinking about that in that context, where could such a movement come from? Because on the one hand, you have people, if you like, Blairite sort of people saying it's all about Parliament, which seems a mistake. On the other hand, you seem to have Corbyn supporters who seem to think the Labor Party itself is the movement, which isn't what history suggests either. Rather, you would think it was trade unions or something else. So where is the movement, and how would one get such a thing in order to have the kind of realignment that you had in the 30s where it happened in a way that was propitious for the left.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a real blurred line between the kind of the party and the movement, especially with what's happened with Corbyn and the Labour Party and then Momentum. What I would say, you need both, right? So you need to have that movement. Given where we are and given, I guess, the kind of what would need to change to get Corbyn elected, or at least for that left politics to really take hold in this country, and for that message to get out there beyond the people that already believe in those messages, is that you do need to have a sense of momentum and movement, right? So why is it that, I don't know, even someone like Trudeau won the election, he didn't start off in a good position. You know, what was the movement, the positivity, the attitudes of people? It's got to be a movement that people want to join. Like, people need to be magnetized to that. You need the movement, because what the kind of Corbynism is about, which is, I guess, different to Corbyn, is that real want for kind of socialist policies, for different values. And so, I mean, I wouldn't probably labour too long on the difference between the two. I would just say you need both. And I think probably right now, given what's happened in the Labour Party and how Corbyn and others have been isolated, is that there's a lot of work to be done within the parliamentary system, as well as, you know, growing the movement.
Okay, thanks. Look, that's really great. It's 5:30, which is exactly the time when we should start taking questions from the floor. I'm going to start by taking questions. I suspect there are quite a number of questions. So if you don't mind, could you please be succinct? And I think I'll start by taking two or three, and perhaps we won't have everybody address every question, otherwise we won't get many in. But could we just start with this gentleman with the hat on the side here? Can I ask each of you to say who you are and where you're from, so everybody knows, please?
Hi, my name's Leon. Thank you for the talk. The question to Andy. You say Labour have to undermine the press, but the press is dominated by Oxbridge and private school individuals. So are you saying that really the only way for a Labour Party to ever take hold in this the UK is to undermine Oxbridge, and maybe even try and think of creating a new institution that is free from billionaires who support New Labour and own the press, and create a new institution which is actually owned by the UK people rather than the billionaires? Would you agree that is the only way forward for a Labour Party to ever win?
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I thought I saw someone over here, but no. So this man with the T-shirt.
I'm a young person who's just come to the LSE from Bradford in the north of England, one of the traditional Labour heartlands. And over the last few years, I've seen how people have become disenfranchised with the Labour Party in the heartlands. George Galloway won a seat in my city. The Liberal Democrats are gaining council seats, not just in Bradford, but across the whole north of England, at the expense of a party which once used to run amok in these cities. But my question comes across young people, because Bradford has the youngest population outside of London in the UK of any major city. And in the recent leadership election, young people between 18 and 24 voted for Owen Smith, not for Jeremy Corbyn, according to the YouGov exit poll afterwards. So my question to you is, where does the Labour Party now consider the young people who support it? At the end of the day, young people are supposed to be these socialist firebrands who will be leftist at university and then go on and vote for Labour. But at the minute, I've been a Labour member for 4 years and I really don't feel the appeal anymore.
Okay, thanks. I thought there was someone. Perhaps could we have this person with the striped shirt? That's what I was looking for.
Hello. Again, sort of similar from speaking about where you're from. I'm from South Dorset, an area which has voted Tory since the beginning of time, despite a brief flirting of Tony Blair, which was short-lived. Again, whenever I speak to anyone at home, the statement is Corbyn has got to go. This man is just so not what we want or what we'd ever even consider. I mean, they think Dorset's more like to sink into the English Channel than vote for a Labour MP under Jeremy Corbyn. So in as brief a sentence as possible, is the only possible way Labour can become a part of government again, is Corbyn going, is that part of that formula?
All right, thank you. I'm just going to direct these questions. The first one's easy, I think. Andy, would you mind talking about journalism and Oxbridge briefly?
Yeah. I quite like the idea of the Daily Mail being nationalised and replaced by a sort of, you know, sort of socialist collective with a very good address. I think realistically that's not going to happen. I don't think it's necessarily the structures of the press that are the problem. I think that you could have a very right-wing press whose picture of Britain was being challenged much more effectively by the Labour Party. I mean, obviously, I'd much prefer the press not to be owned by kind of tax-avoiding kind of horrors who live in the Ritz. But, you know, it's in the 70s. You know, I'm just doing some work about this for The Guardian, about the tabloid discourse. It's fascinating that in 1972, when the miners went on strike, the Daily Mail, the Sun and the Express all supported them. You know, those were very right-wing papers. So when the left is strong and takes on the kind of right-wing discourse effectively...
Oxbridge, the institution itself...
Yeah, we'll yeah. Yeah, fair enough. I mean, I suppose
briefly,
I probably...
It needs to be addressed
full disclosure, I went to Oxford University, so I maybe not be... but I think I think you know, I agree with quite a lot of what you're saying, if I'm allowed to, which is that, you know, I work at The Guardian, I've worked there for a long time, and it's striking that The Guardian has become much more middle class in the 20 years I've been there. When I joined, the other feature writers, there are only three or four of us, the other two hadn't been to university. And now, everyone who's joined since me went to Oxford or Cambridge. So The Guardian is much more racially diverse, it's more sexually diverse, it's better on gender, but the kind of class basis of the paper has become much more limited. And so I think that is a problem. But I don't know. I mean, it's special pleading, but I think the left has done fine in the past with plenty of posh people involved. That's not the problem. The problem is the common sense of the age being created by the right, and that needs to be challenged. And Thatcher understood that from the other end of the spectrum in the 70s very well, and I think the left needs to start doing the same thing now. And until it does that, all these ideas about immigration and so on that inform the kind of stuff that's been, you know, very powerfully shown here on all the graphs about Labour voters disappearing, that has to be challenged. People who think immigration is dominating rural England are living in a fantasy land, and that needs to be in some way challenged, not by telling them that they're stupid, but Labour has to challenge that discourse on things like crime and immigration effectively. And that has to be done by being funny, by being punchy, by being concise. And, you know, I couldn't do it, but clever people can find a way to do that. And until that's done, then I think Labour will struggle. But I don't think ultimately it's about who the journalists are. It's about how the party responds to what they're writing.
OK, thank you. So now we're on rural England, and we've heard about Dorset. I'm not sure that Dorset would ever have endorsed a Labour candidate recently, but at least not in rural areas. Could you just speak to that question?
Yeah, I think we forget how conservative we are as a country. And I scribbled down some stats, and I didn't end up using them, but the combined Conservative UKIP vote share at the last general election surpassed 60% in 227 seats, surpassed 50% in 356, and if you're interested, surpassed 80% in 4, 70% in 94. So, you know, we are a very conservative country overall. But yeah, I mean, Corbyn will never become Prime Minister, and if he does, I will eat a copy of my book, and you can quote that. But I think, as I'm sort of saying, I mean, in a way, I feel a bit sympathetic in a way to Corbyn, because he has taken on the kind of role of being the problem. The problem is not Corbyn, and the problem is not, you know, McDonnell, and the problem is not the sort of the left in Labour. The problem is very much at the core of social democracy, and, you know, unless it gets past this debate about talking about immigration is actually engaging in racism, social democracy is never going to find a way back, right? I mean, this is a, you know, a new dividing line in politics that is going to be with us for a generation, if not more, between people who are liberal and open and those who are fundamentally not so about the world. And there's nothing, you know, there's nothing inherently wrong with that, I have to say. I mean, racism, absolutely. But in terms of wanting, say, the Brexit debate, in terms of wanting to have a sense of control over immigration policy, there's nothing inherently bad about that. The way that it was expressed by certain parties and politicians was completely irresponsible and xenophobic. But as a public preference, you know, that is a legitimate point of view. And I think Labour has always struggled with that, struggled with conceptions of national identity at the same time. And it's going to struggle now. I mean, Brexit was a majority in 70% of Labour-held constituencies. Not among Labour voters, but among Labour constituencies. And in all of those more northern constituencies, the other speaker alluded to, what you're seeing now, you saw the last general election, is a generation of rock-solid Labour majorities beginning slowly to come back into play. So UKIP now second in 44 Labour constituencies, typically between about 25 percentage points between Labour and UKIP. The next general election, this is a threat for Labour, you see. Next general election, that comes down to around 10 or 11 points, and all of those seats actually come into play, and they haven't been in play for generations, simply because of this issue of cultural threat continuously being verbalised by Labour as just about economics. And unless they cover that flank, it could be, you know, game over.
Okay. So the other question was about heartland youth, really. Mm. And, I mean, in a sense, they're two heartlands now, aren't there? They're the heartlands the questioner was talking about, and they're the sort of London heartlands. Do you want to address that question?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a tricky one. I think you could probably tell me more than I could tell you. I mean, I found that really interesting that there were so many young people that did vote for Owen. Maybe that's about pragmatism. I mean, Owen Smith had a lot of the same policies, right? Him and Corbyn all the time kept saying that essentially he didn't disagree with him on many of the policy bits. So it's not like young people are like want something dramatically different to Corbyn, but maybe that it does come down to personalities and some of the pragmatism. I'd really be interested in looking more into that. I mean, maybe some of the polls, et cetera, have delved into it a bit more. I just want to come back on this issue of immigration, actually. I mean, I absolutely agree that Labour doesn't talk enough about values. And I absolutely agree that they didn't speak enough about immigration. There's a really tight rope there, though, and what you say about immigration and that slippery slope into kind of pandering to a belief that is wrong, right? That is actually wrong, that it's because of immigration I can't get a job, it's because of immigration I can't get a house. Like, that's just incorrect when you look at underlying what's happening. I mean, even in terms of what's driving inequality, it's financialization, it's deunionization. Migration is there, low-skilled immigration is there, but it's quite far down the list, right? So, you know, when I talk about being honest about immigration, absolutely we should be, it's not like, I mean, open borders is not where we're at, and we should talk about controlled migration, but in a way, I haven't come up with this narrative yet. And hey, you don't pander to that idea because, look, why has all this anti-immigration sentiment come out? And it's because people have heard a certain story for some time, right? The polls reflect people's opinion, which they've heard again and again from political leaderships and or not saying something, or, you know, the media. So reflecting the polls, I don't know, it seems like tautological somehow. That actually we should be trying to change opinion on this because essentially we don't want to have a really strong anti-immigration sentiment in this country. We want to do something about what's happening at the bottom and we want to understand where immigration is having an impact. And that's why I think, you know, saying things like having a community impact fund and other various policies are really important to Labour's story on this. But I agree that there needs to be more on values. I mean, that's essentially what I was trying to get at in my presentation. Sorry?
Hang on a minute.
The Irish not so long ago were hated in England. The Welsh were resented after the Prince of Wales brought them back here in the 30s. So you're just substituting a different kind of immigration.
Okay, now, let me just take some questions, if you don't mind. Now, I'd be pleased to take... can we have that person in the red at the very back, please?
I'm Jen Beckerman. I'm Canadian, so I always like hearing about Canada and discussions. You mentioned Trudeau and his electoral victory, which at the initial stages of that election, his polling was placing his party at their lowest showing historically for the Liberals. But how he countered that in a way was to present a really strong front bench and a really strong team. The team actually campaigned on Team Trudeau. He was constantly surrounded by really competent, let's say, shadow ministers or a competent team of advisors, etc. I don't necessarily see that on Corbyn's front bench. And I wonder if that... Very diplomatically said. I wonder if that leads to that uncertainty from an electoral perspective, number one, and then in terms of speaking about the future of the Labour Party, how does that affect electoral chances when it's not the A team organizing that party conference? And it sounds like most of you were there watching it on television and seeing the program and the conference program or the fringe programming. It didn't seem like a very well-organized conference. And that often speaks to a party that also isn't well-organized, that doesn't have message discipline, that doesn't have, you know, some of the discipline that it takes to win an election. So that is some of the also troubling underlying issues that I wonder if you could speak to.
Okay, thanks. And could we have a microphone down here, please? This woman with the glasses on the top of her head. And then after that, I'm going to go over there to this gentleman with the tie on.
Hi, my name's Paula. I'm a Corbyn supporter. I am not a member of Momentum, and I am not young. It's a Brexit question, I suppose. Theresa May said something really interesting on Radio 4 this morning. She was asked what made her angry. She said child sexual abuse and modern-day slavery. Isn't it the reality that modern-day slavery, in fact, has thrived under the European Union? And I question some of the perceptions around racism and how that's been presented in the media. Racism has existed for a very long time in many different forms. I think Brexit has amplified perceptions, but again, is this a question of narrative? We have not talked about modern-day slavery and the extent to which exploitation has thrived in the media in the same way that we've talked about racism as a result of Brexit.
Okay, thanks. And finally, this man here.
Hello, I'm Simon McAdam, and I'm a master's student at the university.
Try and speak up a bit. It's a bit... Yep.
Okay. Just very, very briefly on that point made by the Canadian woman, I think that's absolutely... You've hit the nail on the head, really, with regards to Corbyn's front bench. It's a shambles. You've got shadow ministers having to share portfolios because there aren't enough of them. They're completely out of their depth and inexperienced. And if valence politics, valence models of electoral performance tell us anything, it's that public perceptions of government competence is very important, if not the most important factor in swinging undecided voters. But my question regards to... Now, first of all, I want to say I am young and a member of Momentum, and yet I do have this problem with Labour's position and many members of Momentum's position on immigration. The point that Pfizer was making was that we've got to try and challenge the narrative and convince people that immigration isn't their problem. It's actually quite low down when you look at statistics, when you look at how it actually affects people's lives. We need to point it out to them. But this is about the point about values and what people feel. And if people feel that there's a problem with immigration, you can combat it with all the words you like. You're not going to convince people. That doesn't mean that we fight the argument about on immigration, but I think you have to do it by deed. If you can get into government, start putting through those socialist transformational changes for the economy, start to increase people's living standards and show them that immigration wasn't the problem after all, then you'll convince people and win them over in the long term. But just simply going on about free movement and how actually immigration isn't the problem to people who have got this massive backlash that has occurred since Brexit and all the racist remarks that have come out, and people's perceptions of immigration are so utterly in the doldrums that I just don't think you're going to win with a verbal war. You have to get into government, do some good things, then you'll win them over.
Okay. I think we should take some answers there. I mean, we've got the first question was about, well, really the first question was about a weak shadow cabinet, but it was also about Canada. I guess you brought Canada up. I mean, I think it's very relevant, isn't it? We often talk about the US and Britain as though it's all going on at the same time, but Canada's part of this sort of English-speaking universe, and it's just heading off somewhere quite different.
They're winning.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. I see someone with a Canadian hat. I mean, I think there's a lot we can learn from Trudeau. I mean, partly because some of what's happened with Syrian refugees, on the narrative on immigration, on the absolute, I don't know if you saw Trudeau making this really positive speech at the UN about diversity and it being a strength and we're strong because of it. And it was like earlier on in the week, Theresa May made a speech that was essentially all about controlling borders and being very negative. I mean, it was a really sharp contrast. I mean, I think there's definitely something we have to learn from how they won that. I mean, I agree, like, issues of competency and how that's perceived are a big problem. Hopefully the Labour Party are looking at that. I mean, obviously over the summer things happened and it meant that they couldn't fill their cabinet. Let's see what happens now. I was just going to talk about the point about immigration. I mean, I think... So I get your point, right? I have these conversations with people about, no, it is immigration, and you're right. Like, what have we heard recently? No, shut up, you experts. We feel this. If you go and door knock with people, like, I feel that it's immigration. I don't want to hear you, and especially not from me, right? Like, it's better coming from you. But it's that situation of, right, so immigration, like, whether we like it or not, become this huge stumbling block, and I think that's what we agree with here. Like, it's so are you saying that Labour Party should pander to some of those to get in power, and then in order to, I mean, and then to kind of set that right? So in the meantime,
so
when
don't start talking about, oh, actually we should be defending free movement of labour, as the sorry, I forgot your name, but the University of Kent said earlier, it's about finding that alternative that does.
Yeah, I mean, I think I don't. I mean, I agree with that. I'm not, you know, I think.
Jeremy Corbyn's strategy at the moment is to defend free movement of labour, which is just completely out of touch.
Okay. Yeah. Can I just say something about immigration? Please. I mean, all the data we were shown earlier about values and how important they are and how they dominate politics, I mean, I found that data really, really powerful. But I wonder whether now is about as good as it gets for the kind of values crowd, you know, that we've had nothing but talk about values, you know. In the press, you know, Brexit was all about values. You know, in some ways, the 2015 election was all about, you know, Scottish values and whether Scotland was different or not. And I just wonder whether, you know, people who think that values dominate have to be careful what they wish for, because now we're going to have a government that's going to control immigration. So that may take the whole issue out of play. You know, that when immigration has been reduced, and it will be reduced, and yet people in the left-behind areas are still having a bad time, they might think, maybe it's to do with neoliberalism or the amount of tax I'm paying. And those issues which favour the left will come into play again. I think we've had a kind of orgy of kind of listening to people about their values and their identities, and it's been really necessary. But those are not the only issues that kind of create the texture of people's lives. And I wonder whether the values bubble will kind of not burst, but, you know, shrink a little. I just think, you know, Theresa May's sort of showing that a little bit, that she's beginning to talk about economics and about, you know, the powerful and the unpowerful and so on. And I just wonder whether if we restage this event in 5 years' time, I wonder whether Labour voters are all going to say, oh, it's all about values. I think they'll be saying, what about my take-home pay? Or what about my zero-hours contract? And those are kind of economic issues which are problematic for the right and quite good territory for the left, even for someone like Corbyn.
I'm not quite sure what to ask. I think you can choose which cluster of questions you want to answer. Some of them are overlapping. And
yeah, I mean, just a few points. I mean, I did want to pick up on the young people's point because of the audience, I guess, as well. I mean, there's lots of young people here. One of my pet frustrations about the referendum that just went was if you go online and look at the petition for a second referendum, the largest number of signatures, last time I looked, were in Hackney and Camden, then if you go and look at the turnout levels at the actual referendum, those areas recorded some of the lowest levels of turnout. And, you know, ditto 2015, right? You remember Miller fandom and, you know, young people getting excited and, well, I think one of the recurring themes, you know, is that we have and this is not at all to be dismissive, I think it's a real serious issue, but young people are not showing up to the extent that they claim to be and to the extent that they should be. And you know, maybe things would have been different. But in my mind, you know, the architect of Brexit, you can make a convincing case for this, is actually not the sort of immigrant-bashing tabloid press, conservative government, right-wing empire. The architect of Brexit is Tony Blair. And the reason I say that is because if you look at how New Labour marginalised blue-collar workers, shifting onto the middle classes and making a gamble that they could take the working class with them while they engaged in that, and also by not imposing transitional controls in 2004, when pretty much every other EU member state did, except a couple, Blair really did set the foundation for what became a very strong, powerful populist backlash. And if you look at the response to a really interesting question, do you feel that the government represents people like you? If you look among working class respondents from 95 onwards, the percentage who say, I don't feel that the government represents people like me, rockets under a Labour government, under the most successful period in Labour's entire history, right, in electoral terms. So that disconnect is still very much with us. And you can't then go back to those people, and it seems, you know, taking my academic hat off, it seems a bit ridiculous to go back to those people and then say, well, you better just get on with this, because, I mean, this is what the left has always said, globalization is going to happen, get on with it. Whereas the right has always been good at offering a vision. You might not agree with it, but they've offered a vision for what, you know, what that opposition should look like. And I think Labour on that domain is really in problematic territory. I think it has to accept Brexit. I think it has to accept the fact that free movement ain't no more. And I think it has to start thinking very imaginatively and innovatively about what can replace what went before. You know, because it's lost that argument. It's lost it. There's no point carrying on, lingering, saying, oh, no, actually, let's keep this. Let's, you know, let's fight for a softer Brexit as possible. That's going to put you even further on, you know, the wrong side of this particular episode in British political history. I think you have to embrace where we are, try and think about, well, what does that mean, you know, in a new set of policies. I actually agree with you on that. I think that means Labour has to be pushed into uncomfortable territory on identity. And we've been having this debate, as Andy said, for 15 years. Nobody in Labour seems to have cottoned on to it. You know, we've been saying for 15 years, get a grip. It's not just about jobs and wages. People are anxious, intensely anxious about how their communities change. If you run a model on where Brexit was strongest, it was strongest in communities that experienced the sharpest demographic change in the last 10 years. So this myth that people are saying, oh, it's all white communities, that, and they have no experience with the joys of North London and immigration. it's total nonsense. I mean, if you look at the stats, it's in communities that experience the sharpest change. Boston and Skegness, prime example. They just don't like it. Now, that is the reality. I appreciate I might not be in a receptive audience, but that is where we are. So I think we have to really start from there and think about, okay, outside the box, what does a new set of policies on that front look like?
Can I just add something to that, though? I mean, I'm just going to kind of reveal another embarrassing fact, which is I live in Hackney, which is, you know, it's the kind of Hampstead of, you know, 2016. But I'm not convinced by this idea that, you know, where people voted for Remain, they were just living in a kind of cloud cuckoo land about immigration. I mean, I live in a street in Hackney. The council owns half the street. It takes me a long time to get an appointment at my doctor's surgery. My kids are at a local school, which is very, very swollen. Immigration affects me absolutely daily. And the idea that people in Hackney were just sort of thinking, oh, it's all just about restaurants, is a bit patronising. You know, people in inner London experience immigration every single day and its consequences, and they don't think it's all marvellous, but they see the good and the bad. So I don't like this slightly patronising attitude towards Londoners that somehow we just think it's about food and the rest of the country is getting the social consequences. The social consequences of immigration are felt much more sharply, I would argue, in inner London than anywhere else in the country. And demographic change in my street is enormous. I've lived there for 20 years. The people that have come and gone from the council flats, from the, you know, owner-occupied properties, the churn is incredibly fast. People from all over the world all the time, by and large, actually, we get on reasonably well. You know, so I'm just slightly cautious about this idea that sort of Londoners just rather have a rather gilded view of immigration. You know, we're living it. You know, the rest of the country, I don't think, is necessarily. Boston and Skegness, yes. But a lot of places in Britain that voted very heavily for Brexit don't have many immigrants, and they haven't ever had any immigrants since the 19th century. So I'm not sure that I quite buy this idea that it's all about the actual physical change in people's lives that's upset them. I think some of it is in their heads, and it's in their newspapers, and that's where it remains. It hasn't got a concrete impact yet.
Okay, we've got sort of just 2 seconds to have a last comment.
Okay, so this point about embracing where we are, look, we are on the face of kind of real profound change. In other countries, we've seen really, and this is, you know, where maybe the Labour Party is lacking, aspirational leaders that can come forward and give us a different story and a different narrative behind which people can get. There's something really, like, I grew up in London, I grew up in East London, you know, I grew up with all sorts. One of my best friends, the daughter of an ex-dock worker, you know, my husband's Turkish, you know, like, it's a beautiful thing. And one of the things that's really interesting about when you look at something called contact theory, right? So when people are more used to mixing with others, they're much more likely, if they're friends with or mixed with others, they're much less likely to think immigration is a problem. And I mean, that's not an answer of the future of the Labour Party, but I think we can get really negative about immigration because they just don't like it. But actually, something really positive to be told about this country and the diversity. I mean, I think before Brexit, I used to be, I mean, so proud when I would see my family from around the world, and I would say, you know, actually, in some ways, we're like as close to the Martin Luther King dream as you can get. And I can't really say that right now, but I think there is a positive story to be told there. I mean, who disagrees with Martin Luther King's dream, really, even in those places? And I grew up with white working class people, so I'm not, you know, as well, and I'm not completely divorced from that narrative. So I think there is hope there, and we need to leave space to telling that different story. I can't accept to just go with what the polls tell us.
Yeah. Okay. Well, listen, thank you very much to everyone.
I just like to say on record, I didn't say anything about restaurants and food. I'm just going to say that.
You're making people hungry. I think one thing that needs to be said about this is that, to put it in some sort of context, for well over a century, the Labour Party has been the principal vehicle for the hopes and aspirations of the large majority of progressive people. And the future of the Labour Party is therefore a matter of central importance, not just to progressive people, but to their opponents as well. And it's been very interesting listening to this debate and the audience participation. Sometimes we've heard about leadership competence or incompetence. Sometimes we've heard about MPs' recalcitrance. We've heard a lot, I think, about whether it's the interests of Labor voters or the values of Labor voters that are driving the sort of middle-term problems of Labor. And we've heard not very much about an immediate collapse of Labor, which I think 4 weeks ago might have been more at the centre of the debate. So one way or another, this organisation seems likely to continue into the short and medium-term future, and to continue to be the central repository, I think, for these hopes and aspirations. And for helping to illuminate our thoughts about that today, I'd like you to join me in thanking our panel.